From VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And I'm Joanna Sciarrino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the VinePair podcast.
I don't know what happened there.
I don't know.
I'm Zach, like weirdly again. Blacked out.
And I was like, I almost said this is the VinePair podcast before Zach introduced himself. And I was
you just
like,
really hope I'm not here every time.
No, I don't know what happened. I just like, again, I was like, we were like in a flow, Joanna. Yeah. I was like, let's go. Oh, Zach, sorry, man.
It's okay. Well,
I guess because, you know, we did that to you. What have you been drinking?
Yeah.
I'm going to need to after this. No.
Ooh,
well, I always
every
do.
Single time we drink.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, gotta unwind from the tough day at the podcast mines. So I think the most interesting thing I had recently, I had, as you know, happens, I'm sure, to the both of you from time to time, had someone reach out who's a listener to the pod and asked me to if I would be willing to try some of their wines.
Nice.
And for me, this was an opportunity to do something, taste wines from a place that I've very rarely tasted, I think only a couple of wines before, which is from Michigan. And so I had a Brut Rosé from Aurora Cellars in the Leelanau Peninsula, or Leelanau Peninsula, excuse me, up in somewhere in Michigan. I didn't actually look where, and not my area of, I think in by Traverse City, I think, if I'm correct here. And, you know, it's good. It was, as my wife said, you know, it's kind of hard to make a sparkling rosé that we don't at least somewhat enjoy, and this one was quite nice. But you know, it was kind of traditional champagne grapes, so I think Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, maybe had Pinot Meunier in it as well. And yeah, it was just kind of a fun wine. Definitely curious. We talked years ago on the pod about wines from Michigan and kind of that Great Lakes area in general, and I think there's a lot of interesting stuff happening there, both with vinifera and some hybrid or non-vinifera entirely varieties. So definitely an interesting taste for me and kind of a fun, you know, break from my usual wine drinking habits to try something, like I said, I wasn't very familiar with. So I don't know. Joanna, what have you been drinking?
Yeah, I had a few really wonderful cocktail drinking experiences this past weekend. I went to the bar at 11 Madison Park. We're working on an editorial project, so that's part of it. I didn't just go bar hopping for fun, but...
Yes, you did.
Anyway, so yeah, had a few drinks there. One very special one, which was like a freeze-dried aquafaba meringue sour situation with kumquats and gin, which was really special. You know, their whole menu at 11 Madison Park is vegan now, and so it extends to the bar menu as well. And so they're using aquafabas, and they're in aquafaba in their in place of egg whites, right? So
yeah,
so that was really fun. And then I got to go to Shinji's for the first time and had a really great experience there. And I think that's such a, I mean, they're both lovely bars. I had their take on a Vesper there called the Honey Penny, which is a really nice drink that has honey and beeswax and mead, and it's really neat. And that place is just so thoughtful about their cocktail creation. And I went to another bar, you know.
Fine.
Not worth mentioning. But anyway, so yeah, more drinking for me this past weekend than in a while. I had also gone to Dante. I forgot to mention that. But yeah, Adam, what about you?
So this past weekend, I was a little bit recovering from my one night in Charleston. But I went on Saturday with Josh, actually, and Naomi and Lilo and Esty to Transmitter Brewing, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We've always been very... huge fans of their beers here at VinePair. We like their saisons a lot, and it was just a nice. I hadn't been just like to a brewery in a long time, so it was fun to like be at the brewery during that day. And like we brought in food and hung out for a few hours and had some beers. And I had a really. They actually are making an American pale ale now that was really delicious. They also brought out another one of their like barrel aged saisons that was really tasty, a black lager that was really cool. And then their Pilsner, which is just really delicious. So again, it was that was basically the extent of what I drank. And then this past week I haven't had anything to drink. So, you know, I'm looking forward to this
weekend.
How was
Charleston?
Charleston was great.
Brief.
I know that I previewed where we were going when we recorded, but had an amazing time, as always, at Stems and Skins. We had some champagne. I don't even remember what the champagne was. Someone brought over a bottle of Riesling. And I had a really, I would say the best wine I had was we went to the restaurant that Tim really wanted to go to in Charleston, Sorel or Sorelli, et cetera. And I had an incredible bottle of wine. I had a Roera Arnaiz from Bruno Giacosa. Mm-hmm. So Bruno Giacosa makes probably like the most expensive Barolos. Mm-hmm. But this Roera Arnaiz was very affordably priced and absolutely delicious.
Okay, what's very affordably priced?
It was like $70.
Whoa.
It's like one of the more affordable white wines from the Piedmont region on the list. And it was delicious. And like, I don't know, you know, we were just chatting about how sometimes these producers that get lauded for their incredible reds, like their whites kind of,
go under the radar
and people are like, oh,
like,
well,
overlooked or under the radar?
I don't know. What do you think, Zach? Overlooked or under the radar?
Maybe a little of both. I mean, I think there's especially with Piedmont and Italy more generally, you know, we've talked about this, I think, in the pod. I've expressed my love for Italian white wine many times. And I think as an aggregate, Italian white wine doesn't get much attention. It tends to get overlooked almost across the board, whether you're talking about wines in the north, central, or south of the country. But I also think that it's certainly true that with producers that are famed for, in particular these Piedmontese reds, that their whites, if they make them, are afterthoughts. And I think Arnaiz in particular is a variety, and it's fascinating because Giacosa was one of the two wineries that was really influential in preserving the very few plantings of Arnaiz that existed in the 70s, I think, along with Vietti, and their kind of steadfast belief in it as a variety, as opposed to either not planting, not having whites at all, or replanting with more kind of mainstream varieties, you know, what that might have been available to them, Chardonnay, even Riesling. And I think now Arnaiz has kind of, again, lost its whatever luster it had, because Timorosso, which is an even more obscure, even geekier white wine from Piedmont, is like the buzzy wine in the nerd circles. And I remain a big fan of Arnaiz.
Me too.
So, yeah, it's cool. I saw that picture you posted, which is, you know, folks, if you follow Adam on Instagram, you know it's rare that he posts a bottle of wine. So I always take notice, because I'm like, this is a wine that Adam really liked, because not only did he drink it, but he went so far as to take a picture and then post it. So
thanks,
Zach. That's the big seal of it. Well, you know, some of us are a little more, you know, we're more willy-nilly with our wine bottle posting. But, you know, you really save it for the special occasions,
thanks,
I
man.
Feel.
Now I'm just going to post all the time. Mm-hmm. Just a fuck with that.
I think you just don't remember to take pictures of the bottle.
I'm in the moment.
Yeah.
I wish I could be more like that. I wish I more often was not like, I also need to remember this wine via a photograph. But, you know, that's good.
Yeah. So we have another listener question. These have been really fun, and to be honest with you guys, we're happy to do it because it helps us with the topics every week.
Yeah.
So this one comes from Sarah, and I will let you play it, Zach, and then we'll go from there.
Hey, Adam, Joanna, and Zach. This is Sarah from Florida. On your episode about the future of By the Glass wine, and on other episodes, it has been mentioned that wine is being replaced by cocktails because glass prices are so high. I completely agree that restaurants are not doing themselves any favors by the way they are pricing wine, but that is another issue. My question is, if cocktails are priced the same or more than a glass of wine, why does that turn the consumer to the cocktail? It's an equivalent serving. Additionally, if you have four people ordering $20 cocktails, why does a bottle of wine not look like the more economical choice? They could get five drinks from a bottle, which may cost them less. And they may even be able to get two bottles of lesser wine, depending on the market. Are people ordering cocktails because they really don't want wine, or because cocktails are hard to make at home? That's for the average consumer, not for y'all. You also mentioned that wine needs to market itself more like spirits. What is your vision of this? Is it because wine is so terrible at advertising, so younger generations can't relate? I work for a wine distributor and rarely drink liquor, so I recognize my bias. But any light you can shed on these questions is greatly appreciated. Thanks. Love the show.
Whew, all right, so that's a lot to answer. lots of questions there. This was one of those, like, not one question, but like 20 questions. But we're here for it. We're here for it. So I'm going to just take your first parter, which is basically, you know, you were wondering you know, why the consumer basically turns to cocktails over wine when the prices are the same. I think it depends on the market you're in, but a lot of times I hear that from most consumers that the prices actually either are the same, or at a lot of restaurants, the wines are actually much more expensive by the glass, especially when you start getting into the wines that are from the regions that people know or are interested in, right? So like if you're comparing, again, you have to remember that when you think about the average consumer, they're shopping based on brand, right? So what I mean by that is like the Martini or the Old Fashioned or the Negroni is a brand, or the Espresso Martini, and Napa Chardonnay, Cabernet, Beaujolais, Burgundy, et cetera, are brands. Those wines at the majority of restaurants are going to be more expensive than the Martini, because the Martini is using the well spirit, right? And they are hitting a specific price point to make that drink and put it on the list. The Napa Cabernet that they're serving by the glass, or even the red blend, if they're trying to be a little bit more economical, still is being made with Napa fruit. And there's all of that cost that comes into consideration. And so the restaurant is going to charge what that wine costs. And in that regard, I think in most of these places, one of our largest themes, and your regular listeners, I think you know this, is that unfortunately what else we're seeing happen in the world of wine, we've been talking about this for 3 years, not just the last month, is that the Somme is gone, right? There is the death of the sommelier. And so there are not as many trained professionals on the floor who can help guide you to finding explaining and finding that more affordable by the glass option that you might like, and helping compare that to you with the Martini. You're just having a server come over is like, dude, if you're gonna order a drink, that's awesome. That's gonna increase your check size. Like, I don't really give a shit what drink you order. And I think that's part of the reason. Like, no one's sitting here being like, oh, I'm comparing that. It's like, I think it's that the wine list for the wines they know by the glass is actually a lot more expensive than most cocktails.
Well, I also think it's actually important to note that in many cases, the wines by the glass that are on that list are not wines that they know, and they're still as expensive or more than a cocktail. Like, that to me is the fundamental problem, because I think that a lot of places, if you could offer someone a $20 martini or a $25 glass of Napa Cab, a lot of people might choose the $25 glass of Napa Cab, but you're offering them a $20 martini or a $25 glass of Cabernet from somewhere else that they're not familiar with, or Pinot Noir or whatever. And it's, you're kind of trying to, you know, you're just not, those two categories, those two products are not competing on a level playing field, because as Adam said, the Martini is a strong brand, and it's a strong brand almost without consideration to the spirit that goes into it. Vodka or gin, which vodka or gin? Yes, people have preferences. Yes, they might call a specific thing and the menu might highlight a specific spirit. But in a lot of cases, the person who wants a Martini or is going to gravitate towards a Martini or Old Fashioned or Manhattan or Negroni or whatever is in it for the sort of aesthetic of the drink as a larger concept than the very specific taste that one given spirit might impart. And you just don't get that same buzz, not alcohol wise, but just sort of endorphin wise, I think, from ordering either an obscure variety that happens to be on the list for $17 and your server tells you it's kind of like Cab, or the $23 of glass of Cabernet from someplace in California that you're not quite sure where it is. And that's just like, wine has a really hard time because the recognizable wine brands are largely now inaccessible at glass pour pricing for almost anything.
Yeah, I agree. But I also think that in a lot of cases, the price of wine and cocktails are the same, right? It's not even that the wines are more expensive and that's why people are choosing cocktails. I think people just, when that happens, when they're the same price, people find that a cocktail is a better value. And I think that most consumers drink wine differently at home. That is probably a much larger serving than what they're going to get at a restaurant, which 100%. always seems really skimpy. Especially now where you have restaurants keeping the prices the same, but the pours are getting a little slimmer.
From 5 ounces to 4 ounces.
So they're not jacking up the prices. The prices are staying the same, but you're getting less wine. I think that's a huge part of it. And I also think that maybe especially after the pandemic, people are a little wiser to wine markup at restaurants. Like, oh, we've talked about this before. Oh, I pay $20 for this wine at the wine shop. Why am I suddenly paying? Why is it suddenly, $80 on this restaurant menu? That's a stupid decision for me to make. And I think so. I think that that's really challenging. I think maybe before people understood the value, especially if you had multiple people who were going to order the same glass of wine, it makes more sense for us to get a bottle. I also think that people like to start the night with a cocktail and versus a glass of wine. And then maybe they'll move into wine. But
I think your point that we have actually never talked about before that was really smart is the glass.
What do you mean?
So I think...
like how much you pour yourself at home?
Because I think it's that all these restaurants also like if you... So like the number one like glass in America a few years ago was like the big crate, like the huge bulbous Crate and Barrel glass. It was also, I think, the one that Olivia Pope used.
Oh, really?
And yeah, we had written a whole story on it. I don't know if it's still one of the most popular glasses in America, but like, again, most consumers, y'all, are not buying Riedel. And they're not buying, they're definitely not buying Gabriel Glass or Zalto, right?
Yeah.
They're buying glasses at Crate and Barrel or Walmart or Target.
IKEA,
right?
Yeah,
and
these
Amazon.
And they're big glasses.
Yeah.
And they are filling them. And then what nice restaurants, especially in, you know, cities like New York, San Francisco, Seattle are using are Gabriel Glass, Zalto, Riedel. And those glass shapes are also smaller. So, like, I think your point is so smart because it's not only that they're pouring more, but they're also pouring into a much larger glass.
Yeah.
So then when the glass comes in, it looks smaller and it's a smaller pour. People are like, wait, but for the most part, like, martini, it's a standard kind of looking glass. It's same with an old fashioned. It comes in a rocks glass. Like, yeah, it might be a little bit of a different shape, but like most people feel like they're still getting what is a standard martini or that they would make at home. So yeah, like, duh, no shit.
Yeah.
I also think another piece of this and something that we have at least talked about a little bit before is I also think that, you know, especially when combined with the lack of wine focused or wine specific professionals on restaurant floors is the fact that if you are just a server in the restaurant or, you know, someone else who's taking orders, the bartender, et cetera, it is much easier and more kind of compact and cohesive to the restaurant, most restaurants' approach and sort of the way you would perhaps like spiel the menu to a table to talk about your cocktail program, to highlight a few drinks on there, to talk about maybe the ways in which the cocktail program and the kitchen interact. Maybe there's some element of, yeah, we're trying to, you know, be zero waste and we're, you know, reusing all this kitchen ingredient in our cocktail program, or we're, you know, the cocktails are inspired by the same flavors that our food is, et cetera, right? And that is just not a conversation you can have around wine very often. For one, it's not as true. I mean, very few restaurants are making their own wine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And even more to that point, a lot of wine programs operate, you know, they're sort of weirdly stitched on to a restaurant concept and may or may not connect in a really direct way. And I think about this a lot because, you know, we've talked a few times, you know, we had Hannah on to talk about her sort of piece about All American wine lists. And we've talked about like restaurants that might try to really marry their food concept with their wine concept. And those are just few and far between and relatively, you know, sometimes they really, really work. Sometimes they don't. But a lot of restaurant wine programs are kind of like, here's the greatest hits of Europe and maybe some stuff from the US and whatever, and good luck, have fun. And that may or may not connect to the kind of cuisine they're serving, the way their kitchen, their chef, et cetera, approaches food. And it just, I think that dichotomy and that divergence has gotten more, even if people are not, diners are not like acutely aware of it. They're not sitting down and being like, well, why are you talking about locally sourced ingredients, but all your wines come in a container from across the sea? They are at least sort of aware that maybe there's a weird disconnect, or at least it's not as exciting to them as a cocktail program that might truly adhere to that same vision. And again, when people can drink wine at home in their comfortable pants and their big glasses and like in a way that they more want to, but they're not going to make a fucking leek martini at home. That's just like, again, it's just, it's hard to compete with that if you can't offer someone a better price. And I think that's the biggest thing is wine used to be a little bit more affordable than cocktails in a lot of cases. And it just, for a variety of reasons that we could get into or not, is no longer the case.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also think like, you know, to answer your question about whether or not it's about like people ordering cocktails because they can't make them at home. I actually think it's they're ordering cocktails because they're used to making a standard version at home and they want the different version. Like as Zach, you just said, like they can make a standard martini, but like, you know, a leek martini or a ramp martini or whatever, like they're not doing.
That's exciting,
so it's exciting and cool. And they also, because they make them just like the way a lot of us cook, we know the skill and artistry that goes into it because of what it takes us. So then we're like, oh, I can respect the craft, and that's why I want this, because this was made for me, as opposed to, again, the consumer saying, okay, well, this is $20 and it was made for me, this $20, and someone popped a cork. Because again, remember, the consumer's not thinking about all the shit that happened to actually make the wine in the beginning. There was the long harvest, there was the weather, there was the, you know, the crushing, the fermentation, the racking, the bottling, the aging. Like, nobody thinks about that. All they think about is that someone made this drink behind a bar that I can see right now and it costs 20, and someone pulled a cork and it costs 20.
Mm-hmm.
It's the difference.
Yeah, it just it appears to be a better value for so many reasons.
And then I do think right now cocktails are more fun. And so then for your last question, like, I think that the biggest thing that wine can do is try to, as we talked about a bunch here, think about consumption that is beyond the restaurant and beyond the bar, because people are also, cocktails are saying to the consumer, drink it whenever you want. You know, you want to be out with, you want to have an Oscar party with your friends and just make martinis? Awesome. Wine doesn't say that. Wine says, well, what's the food that you're bringing? I mean, I was talking to, again, someone who was like, even these like under $10 wines, if you look at all of their marketing campaigns and messaging, all connect to food. Why? Do you really think that the people drinking those wines are drinking them with food? They're not. They're not. They're not.
Or they're certainly not exclusively drinking them with food.
The only company, and I know everyone wants to hate them, and look, let's be honest, these are not wines that anyone here on the podcast drinks. But the only company that has been very smart at saying drink it whenever the fuck you want is Stella Rosa.
And hey, Joanna and I drank it.
We drink that wine.
Yeah, all the time? You drink it every week? You guys have it in the fridge? No, you fucking don't. But they've been very smart at understanding who their consumer is and saying, we get that this is, as we've talked about, your alcohol delivery system. Mm-hmm. And you like this and it's tasty to you and drink it. However, there are wines at their similar price point. Mm-hmm. Who are saying, drink this with tacos, have this with a burger, shut the fuck up. Mm-hmm. And that's not what any of the spirits companies are doing. And I'm not saying that wine should fully abandon that messaging, because it is so ingrained in wine, especially wines that come from Europe. And the culture and the restaurants and all that shit that we talked about even last episode. But I'm saying you got to expand beyond that, and no one in wine is. And so...
yeah.
Therefore, we're having an issue, and you know, I don't see a lot of people. I'd be interested in you know, Sarah, as a wine distributor, like, are you pounding the pavement trying to get placements at bars, or are you just focused on restaurants? Because that's also an issue, right? If there were more wines trying to sell to bars, saying like, we're for the person that comes in and wants a glass while all their friends are drinking, you know, Negronis,
mm-hmm.
maybe there'd be more people drinking wine. But again, like most reps that I know don't go after bars. They're only going after restaurants.
Yeah.
So, especially when we're talking about on-premise. So, again, wine's its own fault here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's a lot of that kind of circularity to the approach to selling wine. I mean, you know, we talked on an episode recently about why no one knows how to sell wine right now. And I think Sarah's question is a really good illustration of that conundrum, because it's easy. It's not easy, but one thing it's true to say, like, try to make it more fun. That's a hard thing to, or it's, you know, it's kind of vague advice. And I, you know, understand that for some of our listeners who are, you know, depending on selling wine to make a living, they are like, well, that's fun is a, you know, subjective thing. I find geeky wine fun or whatever. But I do think that the biggest part of it is that what Adam said there, and I think it's really important, is that you can no longer look at the standard paradigm of, we sell a lot of our wine, especially certain kinds of wine, only into fine dining restaurants or just, you know, sort of higher end restaurants and specialty retail stores. Because I think that's a dead end. I think it's going to be really hard for wine to regain some of that foothold that it once had in those settings of, in particular, you know, dining establishments. And if you can't compensate with other places where people like to drink, that's going to be really challenging. Mm-hmm. And I think the last thing I want to say about this, because I think it's really instructive here too, in my eyes, is we've talked about it in a few different ways. I'm sure we will talk about it more. But the other thing that is challenging for people, and I was thinking about this as we're talking about the excitement surrounding, you know, some of the cocktails that you might find on a cocktail list and the way that people view cocktails differently than wine is. I think wine struggles because people are excited to see sort of recognizable mm-hmm. brand name spirits on a cocktail list. Mm-hmm. They don't go like, well, why is this drink being made with Tanqueray, right? They recognize, oh, that's a good gin. I want that. Or mm-hmm. or at least I know it. I'm cool with it. And if I want something else, I can probably ask for it. But wine suffers in a lot of establishments where the wines on the list are too recognizable, in part because, as we talked about, there's a jarring price disparity between the cost you pay or what you pay for a bottle of wine at a retail shop, grocery store, online, etc., versus what you're being asked to pay in a restaurant. And I don't have a great solution for that, other than if you're a restaurant that wants to sell wine, you really, really, really need to reconsider how you structure your markups and how you and what wines you stock, and that you kind of can't. It's really hard to make a living selling wine for a lot more money than someone can buy it for elsewhere. On the regular, it's just not going to work for you, I think, in the long term. And for wineries and wine businesses, I think you have to also look at kind of how you're pricing your stuff to those establishments. If you want them to put it on their list, you need to make it work for them financially. You need to work together. And I just think we've lost a lot of that in the industry. And there are a lot of reasons for that. We've covered them on the pod before. I'm not going to reiterate them. But I think, again, it's just like people are not delighted to see wine that they're really familiar with on a wine list in a restaurant in the way that they might be delighted to find a cocktail they're familiar with.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, this has been another fun conversation. Let us know your thoughts. Hit us up at podcast@vinepair.com. If you have a question, like Paul Brady, don't just message me on Instagram, buddy. I asked you to send me in a question, bud. Like, just record that. I don't care what your voice sounds like.
Paul.
Come on, Paul. Let us know. And yeah, again, we really appreciate listeners that send these in, because it gets us like sort of thinking about everything that's happening and what you're thinking about in the industry. So definitely keep sending the questions. And Joanna and Zach, I'll talk to you on Friday.
Have a nice week.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Jabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.